Books on Tape presents To the Last Man, a novel of the First World War, by Jeffrey M. Schara, read by Paul Michael. There must be no course but to fight it out. Every position must be held to the last man. There must be no retirement. With our backs to the wall and believing in the justice of our cause, each one of us must fight on to the end. Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig, Commander-in-Chief, British Expeditionary Force, April 12, 1918. To the reader. No conflict in human history has brought about greater change to our world than the First World War. In no other war were so many nations so transformed, from the borders drawn on maps to the rulers whose empires fell to dust. In no other war was the horror so utterly surprising and so graphically visible to the entire world. And in no other war did the outcome so completely pave the way for an even more tragic war that would follow only 2 decades later. As the 20th century dawned, philosophers and social scientists were trumpeting the arrival of the modern age, a breathless optimism that the thundering stampede of new technology would radically improve the quality of life for people the world over. Overlooked was that human nature had not evolved along with its machines. Humanity's worst instincts for conquest, domination, aggression, jealousy, and barbaric cruelty would become plainly evident. The killing machines had improved as well. It might be best that I describe this book by defining what it is not. This is not a comprehensive blow-by-blow history of the First World War. This book does not take the reader to every corner of the immense war. This is not a history book at all, certainly not in the way that you may be familiar with that term from high school. This is the story primarily of 4 men, told through their points of view, as they might have told the story themselves. They are 4 distinctly different characters who are involved in the war from 4 very different perspectives. This is a novel, by definition, because you are in their minds, hearing their words and experiencing the war and their world as they saw it. The events and each character's participation or observation of those events are as accurate as I could make them, an accuracy to which I am fiercely dedicated. This story does not always focus on those characters who are the most familiar or the most legendary. If this diminishes the book for you, I apologize. What I have tried to construct is a story that will carry the reader through this time alongside the more familiar as well as the virtually unknown. Many of the characters and events in this book are household names. Many definitely are not. If you are familiar with my previous books, then you know that typically I have followed the points of view of commanders, the people at the top. Such an approach here would simply not work. The more modern the war, the farther the commanders are from what is happening in front of them. However, I do not ignore the men who were responsible for engineering what took place in the field, and thus one of the principal characters in this story is General John J. Pershing. The other characters are Baron Manfred von Richthofen, far better known as the Red Baron, Raoul Lufbery of the Lafayette Escadrille, and Private Roscoe Temple, United States Marine Corps. Though these men do not share the same experiences, they have one thing distinctly in common. Each man's life is radically changed by his experience, and each one provides an insight into his time. And each one is very much a hero. In all my stories, I hold tightly to the rule of avoiding anachronisms, both in vocabulary and in speaking styles. While the language of the early 20th century was not so radically different from that of today, differences do exist, and I have made every effort to be true to the time. In addition, it is obvious to anyone reading this story that the German characters spoke German, and most, but not all, of the French characters spoke French. Indeed, many of the conversations between General Pershing and various French commanders took place in French. I have purposely avoided most references to interpreters, and I have made no attempt to differentiate what language is being spoken in each passage of dialogue. Only occasionally do I mention a character's accent. It has always been my feeling that emphasizing the obvious accent or inflections of speech is a distraction, interrupting the flow of the story, and frankly, shows disregard for the intelligence of the reader. It is my hope that this story will both surprise and entertain you. If occasionally you find the images uncomfortable or the storyline unexpectedly tragic, I can offer no apology for that. The story is true. The images are real. And we must never forget. Jeff Shara, June 2004. Introduction. At the beginning of the 20th century, Europe has enjoyed nearly three decades of peace. But the complacency of its people masks a dark shadow growing beneath the various governments that maintain an uneasy hold on their relationships with their neighbors. The Franco-Prussian War in 1871 was an overwhelming victory for Germany and a crushing humiliation for France, a result of centuries of bitter feuding between two distinctly different cultures. With their victory, the Germans take control of the regions of Alsace and Lorraine, which lie along their mutual border. As sorely as the French feel the loss of that territory, there is a final humiliation that plants an even more bitter seed. To celebrate their victory, the Germans stage a triumphant march of their soldiers down the Champs-Élysées, through the core of Paris, a symbolic assault on French pride that only deepens the unhealing wounds of the war. In Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm II rules a country whose pride is in its military. The great beloved heroes of the German Empire are its soldiers, most notably Otto von Bismarck. Bismarck begins to emphasize German preparedness for a war he believes to be inevitable. For him, a generation that has taken a beating is always followed by a generation that deals one. His philosophy spreads through German military consciousness, hardening into a firm belief that France is most certainly planning to take its revenge on Germany by starting another war. Most German militarists accept completely the notion that in order to prevent such a potential catastrophe, Germany must strike first. The most pressing question is not why, but how. The strategy is named for its architect, Count Alfred von Schlieffen, the German military's chief of staff. The Schlieffen plan calls for a preemptive strike into France that flows first across Belgium and slices into France from the north. A massive, unstoppable wave that will wrap around and consume Paris. Von Schlieffen discounts any problems dealing with France's ally Russia, nor does the plan consider any real threat from a French counterattack through Alsace-Lorraine. As designed, the Schlieffen plan would deploy nearly all of Germany's available troop strength and drive them so rapidly to their objective that no reaction from France or its allies will come quickly enough to prevent Germany's rapid victory. The war would be over virtually as soon as it begins. But von Schlieffen does not carry out his own plan. He retires from service in 1906 and dies in 1913. Germany's military planning falls into the hands of Field Marshal Helmuth von Moltke, the nephew of one of Germany's great heroes of the Franco-Prussian War. The younger von Moltke is not the leader his uncle was, however, and he immediately begins to find fault with certain elements of the Schlieffen plan. Von Moltke lacks the confidence of so many of his predecessors, and his cautious nature causes him to amend the plan so that a significant percentage of Germany's strike force is stripped away and placed defensively along the Alsace-Lorraine border. But neither von Moltke nor the Kaiser has the confidence to order the final go-ahead. They require some spark, some specific incentive to justify the order. It comes in Sarajevo, Bosnia, on July 28, 1914. Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the heir apparent to the throne of the Austria-Hungarian Empire, parades through the city, accompanied by his wife, Sophie. The Archduke is keenly aware that throughout the Balkans there is considerable unrest and anger at Austria and its rulers, fueled by centuries-old feuds between the various ethnic factions in the region, most notably the Serbs. His vain and lavish show for the crowds in Sarajevo is obviously dangerous, but the Archduke ignores his advisers and insists that the adoring crowds justify any danger. It is a catastrophic error in judgment. Both the Archduke and his wife are gunned down by a Serbian nationalist. The outcry in Austria is predictable, and the Austrian military seized the opportunity to eliminate the
sample complete. Ready to continue?